Welcome to the Consumer Insights Podcast. Every episode, we speak with an insights leader from one of the world's leading brands to hear how they're integrating consumer insights into strategy to move business forward. I'm your host, Thor Olav Fylogen. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Consumer Insights Podcast. I'm really excited to be joined today by strategy and performance measurement expert, Dr. Graham Kenny. Graham is the Managing Director of Strategic Factors, a business strategy and performance measurement consulting firm. He's also a renowned author, regularly contributing to the Harvard Business Review, and has written more than 100 articles for international journals, as well as 5 books. In addition, he's a member of both the Advisory Council at Harvard Business Review and the Editorial Board of the Journal of Business Strategy. Thank you for joining me today, Graham.
Oh, thanks very much, and thanks for the invitation. You've done your research, I can see. Thanks, Tom.
Firstly, could you maybe take a couple of minutes to tell us about yourself, your journey, and how you came to work in the role you're in today? How did it all begin?
I'll go back to when I finished my PhD, which was at the University of New South Wales. That stage, I was interested in an academic career, and I pursued an academic career for 13 years in Australia. And then I was at the UK at the University of Bradford Management Centre as a visiting research fellow. While there, I made up my mind to go to North America. And I had the opportunity then to work at the University of Alberta, another Canadian university. And then we moved down to San Diego, I should say. And I was there and in all 4 years in North America, came back to Australia, knew that I didn't want to continue to be a professor of management, but didn't know what I was going to do. And had the fortunate opportunity to be CEO of a company that made trusses and frames for houses. It was a turnaround job, and we turned the business around, a team of us, and then sold the business. I didn't own it. I was brought in as a person to do that. Now, you might wonder, why would you bring a professor of management in to do that? And the answer is because I had previous management experience before I took on the PhD. Now, that was a really important change in my life, because that's when a lot of the ideas that have since developed over the last 20-something years started to take shape. So that was a real breakthrough for me. And that brings me to where I am now. And then I started, when I was an academic, I was writing for academic journals. I've written 5 books. But then about 8 years ago, I broke into the Harvard Business Review, and then 1 became 2. And now it's up to 42. So I just enjoy the writing as well. So that's another thing. I get up early in the morning and do my writing when I need to. So that's a snapshot of where I am today and how I got here.
Such an incredible journey, Graham. I mean, I will think it will be inspiring to many of our listeners. But as an expert on strategy and performance measurement, how would you define an insight? And how has the way you define an insight changed over time? And if it has changed, what made it change?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Don't think I put enough emphasis on insights and insight in this whole process. It was a few years ago when I started to think about, well, what am I really doing when I'm talking to an audience? What am I doing when I'm writing something? What is an insight that I can give to people? And what is an insight? But come to your question. It's an aha moment. I didn't think about that before in that way. I didn't realize that. We've never understood that before. That's what an insight is. Now, when I say I didn't put enough emphasis on it, I mean that when I was working with groups of managers, we'd go through a process of analysis and so on, and discussion, and we'd talk about what the business or any organization, could be government, could be a not-for-profit, how it needed to position itself to be successful. But I don't think I pushed far enough. And in the article that came out today in the Harvard Business Review, there's a third step in this whole process, which is about gathering insight. And what I say in the article is push, 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 push till you get that insight, because it's easy just to sort of roll over what we did, what we've done in the past, and then think, well, that was okay. But it's not enough. And that's why I think you've just got to push that a little bit further.
I absolutely love that. And I think that we also see that this is something that's becoming more and more important. So from your perspective, could you help the audience understand why it's become so important? Why are marketing consumer insights so important? And how do you describe the role that insights play in strategy building?
Well, the first thing is, why is insight important? And it's insight gives you competitive advantage. That's it. Now, so insight gives you advantage. The very nature of an insight means that no one else has got it, probably. So if you've got that perspective, if you've seen it from that customer's point of view, and everyone else is seeing it from the organization's point of view, the business's point of view, then you've got a breakthrough. If you've got a breakthrough, you've got an advantage. And it doesn't just apply to consumers or customers either. It can apply to employees, suppliers, any stakeholder group. So that's why I think insight is so attractive. And why today? I don't think it's necessarily why today. I think it's always been important. And I think those firms which have gone ahead of the competition have been able to see something that no one else has seen. You know, for example, Jobs saw something in consumers that the competition didn't see. And then he built a product that was slick, beautifully designed, and so on. So, but you can see it in other cases where people can see a shift in an industry that says television is going to do a lot of harm to cinema, and that online viewing is going to do a lot of harm to television. So those step changes, someone's looked into the future and seen something coming. And then they say, we didn't realize this before. What we can see is consumers now want. Now, how do you get that insight? I'll give you four ways. The first one is introspection. Now, Charles Darwin is a great example. He's not a strategist. He's one of the greatest scientists of all time. In fact, for many, they think he is actually the greatest, because his insights have a far greater impact on our lives than any other scientist. And I was in MIT a few years ago, and I could see his name carved into the stone around the forecourt near the Great Dome next to Einstein and Newton and all the others. And that struck me quite interesting. He was on the left here and the others were going around there. And I thought, well, that's amazing. He's the natural scientist that is up there with Einstein, Newton, et cetera. What he used to do is he used to walk. And he had a walk near his house called the Sand Walk. And he would put a proposition in his head, you know, maybe it's like, it could work out this way. Maybe that's the reason they look like that. And then he'd walk and think. So that's introspection. I know managers that have told me that when they get their strategy ideas, when they get their insights, it's actually not at work at all. It's doing woodwork. It's gardening. It's going for a walk. It's swimming, but there's something where the mind is freed up. So that's number one. The second way, and this is a way that I don't think most organizations use nearly enough, is to talk to the stakeholder group. Let's talk about them as consumers or customers, and ask them, how do you make a decision to choose one organization over another? And then you listen to their stories, you listen to their journey, and then you think, I've never thought about it like that before. And that's number two. Now, there are some cases in which asking people isn't quite so effective, because they'll give you a socially acceptable answer. And employees are like that. And this is why I'm a bit skeptical of surveys. They've got to be done properly, and they've got to ask the right sort of material. So if you ask an employee what's important in their job, they're quite likely to say everything, and then number five becomes money. But their behavior tells you something else. And that's what I mean by socially accepted responses. So I think it's important to go beyond survey to watch behavior. And of course, market researchers do this. They watch people in stores to see what they choose and how they make that decision. So I think there's three. And the last one is not used nearly enough, which is to look outside the industry at completely other industries. For example, I know of a social enterprise in Australia that provides coffee, tea, and biscuits and so on for organisations. And they do that by helping people who come out of prison to get re-established in society. Now, it's a competitive market they work in. How do they become more competitive? Well, actually, they went to Toyota. Now, Toyota is not in that business, but Toyota is very good at knowing what the customer wants, developing the processes, delivery on time, no mistakes, all those things that are very important for competitiveness if you're going to be in that market. And Toyota helped them streamlining their systems. So I think that's another way to gather insight. They're the four things I'd nominated here.
I absolutely love this. And I think they're very helpful steps that you're suggesting. If we tie those recommendations, those different steps with maybe your experience working with a variety of clients over the years, you must have observed many different companies. And how do you feel that the way that companies work with market research and insight has changed or evolved in that time? Do you have any examples you could share?
Well, yes, I can. I'll just start by, I think we've become skeptical of surveys. I mean that in terms of the general public, but also I think managers have become skeptical of surveys. And part of that has been led by some very poor results in predicting, I should say, presidential elections. So they were so wrong on so many occasions. But I've been subjected to surveys. I remember one flight I took with Qantas from here to Sydney to LA, and I was handed this survey form, and it would have taken me 13 hours to fill it out. Honestly, that was the time of the flight. And, you know, you just get halfway through it and you throw it, you know. So some of those surveys are useless. So I think there's a bit of skepticism about surveys in general. I think I see a move towards understanding customer journey, understanding the stories, and I think that's a move that I can see. Now, I'll give you an example now of how we did it with a client, and it was a real eye-opener to me because it illustrated to me the difference between a management perspective and a customer perspective. So the company imported gift products from all around the world. It was a public company at the time. They would bring these products in that have their manufacturer's labels on them. So they're gift products, novelty things, probably around about nothing more than about $20 American, calendars and novelty mugs, those sort of things. Right. So anyhow, the CEO, when I was working with the group, said, I think what we need in order to get more sales is a branding exercise. And what we'd like to do is to put our brand, let's call it the ABC brand, on each of these products. So people then say, I want the ABC product. Now, a lot of on the management team said, oh, that's a great idea. And then we'll be then known for this whole range of products. I said, look, why don't we go and talk to some of the customers? Now, the customers were retailers, and then you had the consumers, which were the people who bought the product from the customer. So we interviewed customers and said, how do you make a decision to purchase the products you do from ABC? They gave us a list of things. So I call these strategic factors, things like margin, customer service, reliable delivery, and so on and so forth. And then we threw this suggestion to them. Do you think it would make a difference if we rebranded the products with ABC on it? You think consumers would buy the product? And they're very close to consumers, right? Now, I said, forget it, waste of time, don't do it. And so the next question was, what do you think the company should do in order to get more of the more sales and so that you're going to stock more of the product? And they said, customer service. And it just came in repeatedly, customer service. I said, what's the problem? Well, we asked, what's the problem? They said, when we ring up, we get shunted around the office. No one takes ownership of our problem. And here we are standing on the phone and we're a retail outlet. We can't work that way. Right. So there's two worlds didn't correspond. And that happens a lot. Now, this is another question I'm often asked. How many interviews did you do? And people are thinking, oh my goodness, we're going to have to do hundreds of these things. The answer is the magic number is 12. That's 10, by the way. The average number is 12. And people think, why would that be the case? And it's called saturation. So that if I talk to the first retailer, that's a good example. If I talk to the first retailer, and the retailer says, look, what makes me buy from ABC or the alternative is customer service, product range, delivery, margin. There's probably one or two other things. And we'll only get about three or four, you know, might only get three from that particular interview. Then I go to the second interview, the third interview. By the time I get to 12, the magic number, or around that number, you'll have heard it all before. Now, we did 16 in this case because we contracted to do 16, but also because we wanted to make sure we hadn't made a mistake. Now, I've spoken to other people in the field about this idea of saturation. It's a term that's used in the market research field. So you can really get into the mind of the customer and then start to understand how they think about the decision, how they approach that decision, what they're looking for, and you can ask for definitions of these things about what do you mean by customer service. You bring that back from 12 interviews back to the executive team and they go, oh my gosh, I didn't realize. Now you can take that to another step. You can actually you can record the interview either by video or audio. And when you play it back to the management team, there's no filtering. And then the penny drops. That's when the insight comes in, you see, because the management team says, well, I didn't realize that. We've never understood that. We've never seen it that way. And there's no filtering that way because it's not just in a report. You've got it now taped and played for the management team. So that's just one example of what we've done. And it's a real eye-opener in terms of two things. I think, first of all, how important it is to go outside and have that conversation. The second thing is how few it took to get to the bottom of the well.
Mm.
And so people shouldn't be deterred from doing it.
I absolutely love that. So you're highlighting the importance of going outside and having that conversation. And the second element, which is really tied to saturation, is how quickly you actually get to the bottom of the well. And that's super relevant. I want to tie it a bit to some of the many great and excellent HBR articles you've written. And I remember you wrote about why data is great, but not a replacement for talking to your customers. So this is, of course, tying, you know, to what you just said. But could you elaborate a bit more on that? You know, what is it that that people often forget?
Yeah, I think I remember one phrase, one sentence in that article, actually. My worry was that managing customers will be the responsibility of the IT department because it's all going to be done by IT. And so the executives will then simply go back to the corner offices and say, well, IT is going to tell us all the answers. I think there's a lot that can be done with big data. I'm not an expert in that by any means. You're the experts in this sort of thing. So I won't tell you what you should be doing. There are a couple of things. And I think if you could pull it together, as you have done with, you mentioned your videos and on site, if you can pull these sources together so people have access to it, this is fantastic. Because the problem with a lot of information, as you know, in an organization, it's in different silos. And I remember I had a conversation with Australia's largest bank here, or executive in Australia's largest bank called the Commonwealth Bank. And they've got 30, I can't remember how many employees, let's say 30,000, it might even be more, could be 60,000. But the thing is that they pull all this together about employees, they pull the stuff together about customers and so on. And then they analyze patterns. And I think there's some value in that. But in that particular article, every time that article, by the way, comes out, it just gets mobbed. I put it out the other day there, and again, it got about, I think it was something like 35,000 impressions in about 4 days, which for me is quite large. I think the issue about using data as it's stored, we've got to be realistic here. A company has taken this data, it's sitting here, we start to relate customer decisions with other things, but it's historic and it's back here. Now, the customer might have moved on a bit and quite a bit in some cases, completely changed their mind about, good one is how in Australia at least, people are changing their minds quite rapidly about electric vehicles. Now, it's been a problem. Australia is very large. Getting recharging stations across the country is a problem. With the landmass of Australia is the size of the United States. So, you know, and most of it's empty because we've only got 27 million people here. That's not an invitation for everyone to come, by the way. We like it a little bit sparse, but you can imagine the problem with electric vehicles. If they've only got a range of, say, I'll give you a number, 200 kilometres, and you've got to charge it, But what you can see now is that shift. And now that shift is going to catch a lot of people that are in the old way of thinking, going to catch them off guard. And there's plenty of other things there. But if you were sort of tracking this in the conversations of the customer and the potential buyer of cars, you'd be able to pick this up a little bit better. That was really the message of the article. It's not to say that you shouldn't use big data, shouldn't be doing the things that you're doing. You know, as I say, it'd be fascinating to see what you could pull out of what you're doing. I think it'd be really, really interesting. But you don't get the journey of the customer. You don't get the emotions of the customer. And in some cases, you can't see certain things just coming around. Like, well, I've heard that before. People are thinking about buying online rather than buying in person. They're too busy. Husband and wife are at work all the time, and they're looking to go to a cinema, and they're wanting someone to look after their child. Why don't we provide childminding services at the cinema at our cost? I think, well, that's an interesting idea because we haven't really quite picked that up. It's not an original thought, by the way. Someone in the US is doing it, but you can see what I'm saying. Unless you got the finger on the pulse, you could miss that.
I fully agree. And I think that the work we're doing at Stravita is really about centralizing and all your market research and allowing you to democratize access to that data. And it's an important component. But as you say, you know, keeping your finger on the pulse and never losing track of what's happening right now, because as you say, you know, a lot of things are happening is essential. But
I think the other thing I've mentioned here is I think there's an attitude in management sometimes that they know it all. The English word is hubris, which is excessive confidence, arrogance even. And I think the idea of being humble as managers and as a group of managers and as a team around a table is very, very important. Not to say we know it all, you know, what's wrong with those customers, that sort of attitude, but okay, so inquiring all the time, looking for insights, looking for better ways to do things. That's the key to success.
Fully agree. I think you're really highlighting a super important element. Something that frequently comes up in my conversations with insights leaders is the importance of customer or, you know, consumer centricity, and how achieving that really requires getting the entire organization aligned with this way of thinking. How would you say that broader company KPIs play a role in becoming a consumer or customer-centric organization? And what KPIs do you think are most important for measuring progress or impact in that area?
Yes, nothing like a difficult question, is there? I think the whole thing about consumer or customer oriented is it's got to come from the top. You know, we've had a lot of discussion about who's the most important stakeholder. In the past, we've talked about shareholder value, and then in this idea of purpose, we've replaced shareholders with customers in some cases. And then the business roundtable in the US 2019 said, well, actually, it's all about stakeholders, which was a huge breakthrough because I've been talking about stakeholders for 30 years, and I'm not the first one to talk about it by any means. But having talked about, having brought up stakeholders in our conversation here, I think it's important to think about it in that way. But also, it's got to come from the top, as I started on that thread. Got to come from the top and how we think about things. So the importance of customers, if it's not in everything that the CEO says and other managers, then it's not going to take off. Now, as far as KPIs go, the way I develop strategic plans, and there's nothing wrong with strategic plans, although there's a lot of stuff out there that says there's no such thing, is we look at it from the outside in. So when you start to look at what you're doing from the outside in, you ask questions about what the customers want. For example, a convenience store, you know, location, hours of operation, range of goods sold, store presentation, price. Where are we positioned on that to have a competitive advantage? And that's the strategy part. Now, measurement. Measurement's a two-way street. We want to measure how well we're doing with the customers on those very same things, which is quite economic. We've identified the strategic factors that are important to customers of a convenience store or any business. We've then said, this is where we stand. We want to be the cheapest. We don't want to be the cheapest. We want to have the best customer service. That's going to be our hallmark. Now we develop metrics around those things, which are the things that are important to customers. But we also measure the success of those metrics or success of our efforts by revenue flowing back to the organization. So that two-way street is really important on a scorecard. And it's important for all stakeholders, employees as well, because they have that same relationship. So anyhow, that's the thing. Measurement is a two-way street. You've got to bear this in mind. So it's not just enough to measure revenue or market share, but you have to also measure the things that drive those results.
Which we could tie to what you said about, you know, outside in and inside out, right? It's like one is from the internal perspective and one is from the external perspective. But you've also written extensively on diversification strategy. In fact, a whole book. So what insights do you think companies need to have when evaluating whether or not it's the right time to move for them?
It's an interesting endeavor I took on to write that book. I'd written about diversification in articles before, but I took on what I really wanted to do with that book was to see how successful diversifiers do it. What happens within a successful diversified business? So I looked at a number of businesses. They had to, over a 10-year period, at least 14% return on equity. And having chosen those businesses, I looked at what they did. Now, in other words, their management practices. The first thing I'd say is people seem to get frightened of diversification because there's a literature out there that says you shouldn't do it. But on the other hand, what we find is diversified firms that are successful. So that's a contradiction. The big mistake I think that people make in diversification is they diversify and then they kill off the diversified entities by bureaucracy. So they don't allow them to run their own shows. Now, we have a very successful diversifier in Australia called Wesfarmers. It's probably Australia's eighth largest company. It's diversified in the sense that it has a big chain of hardware stores. It used to be in retail, which was at food supermarkets, recently floated that. But it's in a number of other things as well. Now, what it does is it allows those businesses to run independently without interference from head office. So you might wonder, why do we need head office? And the answer is it coordinates and allocates funds. So it then has a role of building the culture, and there's a sort of Wesfarmers culture, but then there's another subculture within each of the industries. It allocates funds to whichever area at the time is doing well, and, you know, businesses can come up and down. So I just think there's about five different features of a successful diversification. But the point I'd make about, I think the main point I'd make about it is, one, don't be frightened to diversify, but two, make sure you do it properly. And three, one of the elements of doing it properly is to allow autonomy to the diversified entities and not try and continually crush them by this sort of bureaucratic conformity, which can happen.
I think that's a super powerful insight. I think that autonomy piece is probably many times forgotten. But the way I gather is it's actual fundamental part to make it successful. If we think a bit about our audience, and a lot of them, of course, are insights professionals. And if you could give them some thoughts or advice, what opportunities do you think there are for insights professionals to make true business impact and challenge the status quo, or as you've aptly described it, strategy as usual?
Yes, that's from an article I wrote about strategy as usual, and I'll just give the story behind that article first. This was a situation where I was standing up in front of a group of executives for the annual strategic planning event, and as we went along using the whiteboard, flip chart, got to about started nine, it's probably about 10:15. This is a few years ago. And from the back of the room, I heard this voice from Frank. And Frank said, I don't know why we do this every year. It always turns out to be business as usual. And at the time, I went, oh, and I was, you know, pretty young into the consulting game at the time. I said, oh, this is a bit embarrassing. But it was a really good point, because they had done it the year before and the year before that. I wasn't involved in it at that point. And what Frank was saying is nothing seems to change as a result of these meetings. And that was a moment of truth, because I thought, well, is he right or is he wrong? It took me a while to realize he was right. At the moment, I thought, oh, I can't really go down that path. And at morning tea, when we had the break, everyone's coming up and saying, sorry about Frank. Oh, that's just Frank. Don't take any notes of Frank, all that sort of stuff. But Frank was right. I think that's what I was driving to in the business as usual, strategy as usual, that there is a tendency for people to meet each year for their annual retreat. Maybe it's a day or two. They roll over the what they have done the year before, add a bit to it. But it doesn't kind of go into the depths of, you know, the so what's, you know, what if, more what if than so what's. And that's when insight arises, you know, and say, what if we did this? What if we did that? And Frank was saying, look, it's just basically a budgeting exercise. So that's why I wrote that article. And again, it did resonate with a lot of people. And I think as far as the people that are involved in this in any organization, just be aware of the fact that there is a tendency to just kick over the traces and continue on, and try and design these sessions so that they really are insightful. And that can mean thinking completely differently, setting up groups that now think, well, we're the ones that are supposed to say how this business could fail. Think about all the ways a business could fail. Just an example. Think about what might happen to our product line if someone came up with this. So that the session now becomes a bit more of less of a group think and more of not so much a combat as a contest. We're contesting some of the taken for granted. So the customer insight professionals should be the ones that are saying politely, we're going through the same stuff. Let them be frank. I don't know why they do this. We do this every year. It always turns out to be business as usual. They could be the point guards that watch out for this kind of tendency. And it is a tendency. It's a thing that we all do. It's a natural thing to get together and say, okay, so how do we just keep this machine running? the other side of it, the insight is to say, what could happen that will completely blow us out of the water? What is it that we're missing? Is there something that we haven't seen? That's the kind of insight piece, which I think you can do.
Thank you so much for that advice. I think it's very helpful. And I know it's might not be an easy thing to do, but it's definitely part of what we need to do as insights professionals and in large organizations. Dr. Graham, unfortunately, we've gotten to the end of our conversation today, which really hurts me. But I do have one last question I want to ask you. It's a question I love to ask, which is, who in the world of insights would you love to have lunch with?
Well, that's a really interesting question. And you know, I saw something yesterday, and this is not because he's Swedish. He won the Nobel Prize for medicine, and it was something to do with DNA and the Neanderthal man, so much man, but Neanderthal time. And they asked him, what drove him along? What drove you? And he had the one word, curiosity. I hope I'm not misquoting him here, but I think I heard him say curiosity. What drove Darwin? Curiosity. What should drive consumer insight people, the people we were just talking about a minute ago? Curiosity. So I'd like to have lunch with him and just find out what curiosity means to him, how it's driven him over the years, and any advice he might give people like me about maintaining curiosity.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that. I believe Svante Paabo won the Nobel Prize in 2022. And I absolutely love the fact that you brought Charles Darwin into the world of insights. I think that was such a powerful connection I think many of us had not made. Wow. This has been such an inspiring conversation, Graham. I think the perspective you brought from the disciplines of strategy and performance measurement is incredibly relevant for insights leaders looking to integrate insights into more areas of the business. And in particular, I think you've really underscored the importance of what they do. I bring with me a lot of learnings. I think that when we talked about insights, you reminded us that it's really the aha moment. It's the things we've never understood before. And the importance of push, push, push to get that insights, because at the end of the day, it is important because it gives you competitive advantage. And the breakthrough that it allows you to do is an advantage. You also gave us a couple of advice, you know, to one, think about introspection. And you talked about, you know, how Charles Darwin walked to free up the mind and to unpack hairy problems. Two, to talk to stakeholder groups, to customers on how they make the decisions to actually choose one choice of another and listen to the journey that they took to get there. And three, avoid socially acceptable answers by actually watching and monitoring people's behavior. And four, looking outside the industry in which you are to completely different industries for inspiration. I love the fact that you said that you've seen on multiple occasions how the penny drops for the management team when they access information and there's no filtering, and how that underscores the importance of getting outside of the building and having those conversations. That in fact, although you'd love to reach out to hundreds of people, the magic number 10 or 12 tells you something about how quickly you can actually get to the bottom of the well. I know I've learned a lot from talking with you today. As a matter of fact, I think it's been a masterclass in insights and strategy. And I'm sure our audience has enjoyed it as well. Dr. Graham, thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity and all the very best. Hope we chat again.
I hope so too.
Consumer Insights Podcast is brought to you by Stravito, the user-friendly enterprise insights platform. To find out more about Stravito, visit stravito.com and make sure to search for Consumer Insights in Apple, Google, Spotify, or anywhere else podcasts are found. Click follow so you don't miss any future episodes. On behalf of the team here at Stravito, thank you for listening.